Do you love me? That's the question that Jesus is asking you and me, all of us this morning. Do you love me? It's a big question. Maybe the most important question that Jesus will ask us, or the most important response that we'll ever give to any question that we're asked. Do we love Jesus? Johnny Sylvester loved Babe Ruth. And it made sense why. Born in 1915, he was growing up in Babe Ruth's heyday. He lived in the New York area, and he was a huge Babe Ruth fan. In fact, when Johnny Sylvester was 12 years old, he was such a good baseball player, and everybody knew how much he loved Babe, so he was known as, his nickname was the Babe Ruth Kid. 1926, he's 12 years old, and Johnny is accidentally kicked in the head by a horse. A serious injury, one that landed him in the hospital, but one that got a lot more serious when he developed an infection from it. In fact, in the fall of 1926, the doctors thought that because of the infection, it had become a life-threatening illness. And his family, of course, concerned and worried and trying to cheer him up in the middle of this incredibly traumatic time, they sent a telegram. Now, this is where it gets a little fuzzy because movies are made and took some artistic liberties. But the best I can tell, the truth is that his uncle and his dad sent Babe Ruth a telegram. Babe Ruth was playing in St. Louis because 1926 World Series, and the Yankees and Cardinals were in the middle of that series when he got this telegram about Johnny and how sick he was and how he might die and how he was a big fan. And so Babe Ruth sent back to the hospital two baseballs, one autographed by all the Yankees and one autographed by all the Cardinals. And it included a note that said, "Johnny, I'll hit a home run for you on Wednesday in game 4. Well, if you know the story, you know that Babe Ruth did not hit a home run for Johnny in game 4. He hit 3 home runs, and Johnny recovered that fall. The doctors weren't sure exactly how, and they weren't exactly sure how to explain it. The newspapers called it a miracle. But what we know for sure is that when Babe Ruth got back, and they lost the series to the Cardinals, but when he got back, he went and visited Johnny Sylvester at his house. And while the doctors may not have been able to explain it, and while the newspapers may have called it miraculous, Johnny knew what had happened. He loved Babe Ruth because he believed that Babe Ruth had saved his life. Our love for Jesus, whether we have a love for Jesus or how deep or how passionate or how real our love for Jesus is, comes down to this. It's always connected to what we believe Jesus did for us. Our love for Jesus is always connected to what we believe that Jesus did for us. It was 2,000 years ago when Jesus asked Peter this question, "Do you love me?" Peter was one of Jesus' original 12 disciples, and when Jesus asked him, he didn't just ask him once. In a relatively short conversation, he asked him 3 times. It was like a rapid-fire succession. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And when Jesus asked him 3 times, it wasn't coincidence. There was a reason behind those 3 questions, or asking that same question 3 times. But before we get to that story, I want us just to think for a moment, why is this the question Jesus asked? Why does Jesus ask us, do you love me? Why is it so important? A lot of it comes down to what you think a Christian is. A Christian is not somebody who is busy for God, doing lots of things for God. That's not a Christian. But at the essence of Christianity, at the core of what it means to be a Christian, is to love Jesus. There's this conversation that happens. Really, it's probably more of an argument between Jesus and some of the religious leaders of the day. And what they were arguing about doesn't make that much difference to us this morning. There's a line in there. There's something Jesus says, though, that's really important to what we're talking about. It comes in John chapter 8, verse 42. Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I have come here from God." So do you see what Jesus is saying? He's saying, look, if God were your Father, you would love me, but you don't love me, and God isn't your Father. See, what Jesus is saying there is that a person might not know much about the Bible, they might not have much theological knowledge, still be a Christian. A person might not have much courage to publicly identify with Jesus and still be a Christian. A person might commit some serious sins and still be a Christian. But if a person doesn't love Jesus, that person's not a Christian. If God were your father, you would love me, but you don't love me, so God isn't your father. See, at the core of what it means to be a Christian is to have a love for Jesus. And so I know our natural reaction is to go, well, what's that look like? What's that mean? And sometimes I think we make spiritual questions far more difficult than they really need to be. What does it mean to love a person? Well, if you love someone, you think about him. You listen to her. If you love someone, you take their advice. If you love someone, you speak well of them and you want to please them and you take an interest in them and even take an interest in their friends. And there's a sense in which you just want to be with them and talk with them because you love them. You enjoy being around them. Well, same with Jesus. If you love Jesus, you think of him and you listen to him and you want to please him and you take an interest in his friends, which in Jesus' case means all those other people who want to follow Jesus, and you try to live a life that honors Jesus, and there's a sense in which you are eager to talk about him because you love him so much. You want to talk about him, but you also want to talk to him. And so you're finding yourself going through your day thinking about him and wanting to do life with Jesus because you love him. Now there's one more thing that Jesus talks about, how a love for him will manifest itself in our life. And just to be perfectly blunt with you, I added it late last night because most of the week I tried to avoid this verse because I thought it's going to send us down a hole and I don't have time for it. And it's pretty hardcore. But then last night, before I went to bed, I thought, okay, it's pastorally irresponsible to not show them what Jesus said here. So here we go, John 14, 23. Jesus replied, "Anyone who loves me will obey my teaching." And then in the very next verse, "Anyone who does not love me will not obey my teaching." You see what I mean by being hardcore? I mean, Jesus says, he says that if you really love me, it will be manifested and that you're going to have this desire to obey me. And if you don't have that desire to obey me and kind of moving that direction in your life, then it means you don't love me. Now, Jesus is not saying that if we love him, our life will be totally in line with his will, that we'll never sin. He's not saying that. Of course he's not. But what he is saying is that if we love him, then we're going to want to obey him, and we're going to ask people to pray for us that we would obey him, and we're going to pray ourselves that we would obey him, and we're going to want to bring all of our life, all of our relationships, all of our career, all of our conversations, all of our money, all of our parenting, all of everything under his lordship. Jesus, I want to obey you. I want to. I know I don't completely at all, but I want to. But it's pretty hardcore because Jesus says if you're not trying to obey me, what Jesus is going after here, just to be blunt, is that if you've made peace with sin, like there's just some sins that you know that bother Jesus, you know it's out of line, and you say, I don't care. I'm just gonna do it anyway. That area of my life is walled off and Jesus can't get in it. That area of my life, I'm gonna do what I wanna do and I don't really care what Jesus thinks. I've made peace with my sin and I'm moving on. Jesus is talking to that part of every one of us. And he's saying to us, if you love me, you'll obey me. And if you are unwilling to try to obey me in these all areas of your life, it may very well be because you don't love me. So we can spend an hour on that and not exhaust all the good things to talk about that. But we're going to move on, right? We're going to move on. And we're just going to ask the question, why does Jesus ask us, do we love him? Why not, do you serve me? Or do you know a lot about me? Like if you took a test about me, would you pass it? Or maybe not even like we talked about, do you obey me? Jesus doesn't ask those questions. Why? Because I think he knows that we could obey him and serve him and know a lot about him and not love him. But if we love him, If we love him, then we'll get to know him. We'll want to get to know him. And if we love him, we'll want to serve him. And if we love him, we'll want to obey him. So there's this sense in which he knows that if we love him, then everything else eventually, over time, comes along with it. So maybe the thing we need most in our life today is a deeper love for Jesus. Let's look at the story in John 21 of the time that Jesus asked Peter this question, do you love me? And we're looking at this story because I think in it there's some powerful truths that will help us love Jesus more. So we start at the beginning of John chapter 21, which, by the way, is the last chapter in this book. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus. Now, both those words, Thomas and Didymus, they both mean twin, the word twin, in different languages, Aramaic and Greek. So Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John, they were brothers, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them, and they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. So first of all, it's just like, what a bummer to be these other disciples, right? I mean, everybody else gets named and you don't. It's like seeing your picture on Facebook and everybody else is tagged, but you're not. And you're like, well, what's wrong with me, right? I mean, Simon Peter gets two names. Didymus gets two names, Thomas and Didymus. Nathanael, we find out his hometown. But I'm just one of the other disciples. But what I'm more interested in here, because I think it's more spiritually significant, is what does it mean that Peter goes fishing? I mean, that's what he used to do, right? He used to be a fisherman before he started following Jesus. But to understand the spiritual significance of Peter going back to fishing, we've got to go back in time a little bit, earlier in the story of the gospel, when Jesus is saying to his 12 disciples, hey, it's going to get bad here in a little bit, and all you guys are going to leave. All you guys are going to disown me. All you guys are going to deny me. All you guys are going to forsake me. And after Jesus tells the 12 that, listen to what Peter says. Matthew 26, verse 33. Peter declared, even if everyone else deserts you, I will never desert you. Translation? Jesus, you may have picked a bunch of goofballs as your other disciples. They might be traitors and losers and mistakes, but not me. Not me, Jesus. When the chips are down, I'll never leave you. I'll never desert you. And Jesus says, Peter, you're going to be the worst of the bunch. Before the day's done, before the rooster crows, Peter, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter's like, no, not me. No way. No way. I'm all in. Maybe these other guys, but not me. And then a few hours later, maybe you know what happens. Peter is standing around watching the mock trial of Jesus, and he's standing around this campfire with some teenage girl comes up to him and says, are you one of Jesus' followers? And he's like, nope, not me, no way, don't know him, who's that? No, this guy? No, don't know, have anything to do with him. And two other people, so three times Jesus is denied by Peter, and when Peter is uttering that third denial, he hears that rooster crowing, and all of a sudden he's at his lowest point. All of a sudden he's humiliated and embarrassed, and he knows that he has failed Jesus. And so what happens at that point? Well, he thinks there's no way God will forgive me, no way to get past this. So when it says in John 21 that Peter has gone back fishing, the reason he's gone back fishing is he's gone back to his old life. He's sure that Jesus won't forgive him, that Jesus can't forgive him. And even if he can forgive him, he'll never use him. Peter thinks he's committed this sin that is so great and so grievous and so serious that he will never be right with Jesus again. So he goes back to the old life. He goes fishing. But when he goes back, did you catch it? That he doesn't catch any fish. When he goes back to fishing, he doesn't catch any fish because the old life, it doesn't work any better now than it did before. I don't know how these guys made it apart from Jesus. It seems like they never catch any fish unless Jesus is there with them. Yeah? Life never works apart from Jesus. Life never works apart from Jesus. When you're living out of sorts with Jesus, you can do nothing. and you catch nothing. But at that point where they're failing, that's where Jesus steps in. Verse 4. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. And Jesus knew they hadn't caught anything. And yet he asks this question, "Catch any fish?" "No." "Hey, I'll give you some fishing advice," Jesus says. "Throw the net on the other side." It's like the guy who is a football coach and they lose the game and you read the paper the next day that they lost. But you ask him anyway when you see him, "Hey, did you win that game, coach?" No, we got killed. "Hey, did you ever think about running the ball more? Because maybe that would have helped." And the coach is like, "Oh, thanks. I never thought of running the ball more. I appreciate the advice." So that's what's happening here. Jesus is giving professional fishermen fishing advice. But I want to stop with, why did he ask him the question in the first place? He knew the answer. Why did he ask him if they caught any fish? Well, we've wrestled with this already, and we're going to wrestle with it all summer in this sermon series of the questions that Jesus asked. But I think what it comes down to is that he asked this question because he's trying to get them to be honest with themselves. Sometimes, a lot of times, all the time, I don't know, the first step of following God's plan for your life is being honest with yourself about yourself. To just say, "I realize that apart from Jesus, my life isn't working. That I'm tired of these relationships in which I wake up feeling empty and hollow. I'm tired of pursuing success in a way that people have told me this is supposed to satisfy me, and it doesn't. I'm tired of life without Jesus. I'm tired of catching nothing." Have you caught anything? Is your life working apart from Jesus? Are you being honest with yourself about where your path is headed? Is this the path you really want to be on? How long will you tell yourself a lie to get yourself through another day? Are we willing to be honest and say, "You know what? Life apart from Jesus never works"? Well, the disciples, they listen to Jesus. They put the nets in on the right side of the boat. The fish start jumping in the nets. Peter realizes, hey, it's Jesus on the shore talking to us. He jumps off the boat and swims to the shore. We pick up in verse 9. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you've just caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to him, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Now, people always want to know, what's the significance of 153 fish? And as far as I know, nothing. There's really no significance to it, at least not spiritual significance that's applicable to our life. I think it is kind of cool, though, that it mentions 153 because what it does is it shows that the Gospels were written based on eyewitness testimony. That probably what happened is these fishermen, they caught their fish and then they had to divide them up, and so they counted them out among everybody and there ended up being 153 of them. And this detail doesn't really make a big point, but it's just the way the story was told and so it's recorded here. And it gives us confidence that the Gospels were written based on eyewitness testimony. But I don't think it has a lot of spiritual significance, maybe none. But what I'm more interested in is, why is Jesus cooking? I mean, this is the God who spoke the world into creation. All he's got to say is blackened redfish, and it's right there. Why cook? Well, what's he cooking on? He's not cooking on a gas grill or an electric grill. He's not cooking on a green egg. Jesus, it says, is cooking on a charcoal fire, a charcoal fire. Now, to get the significance of that, We got to go back to the time that Jesus is being denied by Peter. Okay, so John sets the scene a few chapters earlier of Peter's denials. Here it is, John 18. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. The only two times that we're told about a charcoal fire, one when Peter is denying Jesus, and the other when they get on the shore and they see Jesus cooking for him. We know that there is a strong connection between our sense of smell and our memory. And so when Peter swims up and gets up on shore, what he encounters is the smell of a charcoal fire. Probably the last time he'd been around a charcoal fire was the time that was the lowest point of his life, the most embarrassing, humiliating, serious sin he had ever committed. He was at a charcoal fire, and all those memories come flooding back to him. Jesus is intentionally bringing him back to the moment where he denied him. Jesus has a purpose about this. He's bringing him to his lowest moment for a reason. Right after this, right after the next verse, verse 15, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Why more than these? Well, remember, who are more than these? Well, they're the disciples. They're the other disciples standing around that we've been told about that were there. And why does he say, well, do you love me more than these? Well, because remember back when Peter was denying Jesus, he said, look, all these other people, they might deny you, but I won't. So they might be losers, but I'm not. So now he's again bringing Peter back, not just through the sense of smell, but through the question that he's asking, to that moment when Peter was at his lowest point. See, he asked him, do you love me? Do you love me, Peter? And Peter says, yes. And then he asked him again, do you love me? And he says, yes. Then he asked him a third time, do you love me, Peter? And Peter says, you know that I do, Lord. Yes, I love you. Three times Peter denied Jesus, and three times Jesus asked him this question. I think what God is saying to you and me this morning is that his grace covers all of our sin. I think that what God is saying to us this morning in asking that question three times to match the three denials of Jesus is that God's grace is sufficient to pay for every sin, your past sin, your present sin, your future sin, the sin that you think is the smallest and the sin that God knows is the biggest. God's grace in Jesus Christ is sufficient to cover it all. God's grace is big enough to meet your needs. See, he's very purposefully taking Peter back to the lowest point to drive home something. And one of the things he wants to drive home is that grace is not spiritual amnesia. Like, oh, I believe in God's grace. I don't remember any of my sins. No. He's taking Peter back to his sin. He wants him to remember his sin. No, why? It's not to get stuck in the past. Some of us in this room this morning are stuck in our past sin. We can't get by it. And sometimes that requires a friend, a good friend, or a good small group, or a counselor to help us process it and get out of the past. God is not bringing Peter back here. God does not bring you and I back to our lowest moment to get us stuck in the past. But neither does he want us to forget it. Because when we remember our sin, we appreciate God's grace. When we remember our sin and the depth and the destruction that it wreaked in our life, we will love Jesus. We will appreciate the grace that he gives, the grace that covers all of our sin. I mean, can you imagine if Peter had denied Jesus today? Somebody would have gotten that on their phone, right? That somebody would have made a video of it. It would have gone viral, and everybody around the world would know about Peter's worst sin. And you know our culture, we do not forgive. Oh no, we hold whatever your worst thing is, we hang it around your neck and make you live with it. We take your worst moment and let that define you. Oh, but not Jesus. And Jesus forgives all those who trust in him. And Jesus forgives every sin of those who trust in him. He does not hold our sin against us. He forgives us. His grace is sufficient to cover all our sin. But I want you to see the connection. I want to make sure you see the connection between Peter, I forgive you, and do you love me? Jesus asked, Peter, I forgive you. Now, do you love me? I want you to see the connection there. And here's what I think it is. I think the more that we accurately see ourselves, the more we accurately see God, the more we see all that God is for us in Jesus, all that he's forgiven us, the more we see his grace, and the more we see what it did in our life, the more we will love Jesus. That's why he says, Peter, I forgive you. Do you love me? I want to just stay here for just another minute. It's too important to move on from. I have some diagrams. So this is a picture of rudimentary picture, right? Of how, notice the top, our perception of what God did for us. Keyword, we'll come back to perception. But here God is high and holy, and God is majestic. There is no darkness, no sin. He is pure. And we are sinners. We are desperate apart from God. We are spiritually bankrupt. And there's this huge gap, this huge infinite sin gap between us and God. And the cross comes to bridge that gap. And that cross is huge because it had to pay a huge debt on our part. But religious people, church people, people like you and me, we are prone to fall into a trap. And that trap is that we are prone to minimize God and to exalt ourselves, to look around at other people and go, I'm doing pretty well. And I get used to God's holiness, so it doesn't shock me anymore. I look at myself and compare to others, and I'm like, well, I'm getting better. I'm not like them. And so what happens is that we shrink this gap between God and us. God comes down, we go up. And it's not that we think we're perfect. Nobody thinks that here. We all know we have sin, but it's much smaller now. And so the cross then shrinks. The cross gets much smaller. It's like the cross becomes like a little booster chair. I can't quite reach it on my own. It becomes like a little step stool. So before it was this huge thing that came and rescued us. Now it's like, oh, I need a little help. Jesus, a little help. You know, this person has a little love for Jesus. They have some love for Jesus, but just a little. Don't love him much because he didn't really do that much for me. I mean, he helped me. He loaned me a quarter for my lunch, but not that big a deal. But let's just go back for a second to that big cross. And remember, this is perception, because this is reality, but we don't always perceive it that way. This person, when they get it right, when they get who God is and who we are and how huge this cross is and all that God did for us in Jesus, that person loves Jesus. That person loves Jesus. And not because they have to. It's like not like you dig this up in yourself. Like, I'm going to go home and I'm going to love Jesus more today. That's not the way it happens. It happens in a response, right? It's always as a response. So 1 John 4:19, we love him because he first loved us. We love him because he first loved us. It's a response to what he's done for us. Does a person drowning in debt love the one who comes and pays for all their debt and gives them money to live on? Does the prisoner of war love the one who at great risk to their own safety comes in and frees them from their prison? Does the slave love the one who came and bought them out of slavery and set them free? Jesus is the one who paid our debt. Jesus is the one at cost to himself, came to rescue us out of the prison of sin. Jesus is the one who bought us out of slavery and set us free. Do we love him? Well, of course we love him. Look what he did for us. So the music team comes back. I want to tell you a true story. It's about a Vietnamese family, and I may get this guy's name wrong. I apologize if I do, but best I can do is Lap Vi Ho. Lap Vi Ho was living in Saigon in 1975, The American troops were leaving Vietnam at the time, and because he had helped the Americans, his life, his family's life was in danger. At least that's what he thought. And so he took his pregnant wife and his little boy and got them out of the country. They went to Bangkok, Thailand, which was a safe space. And so he thought he would meet up with them soon. A few days later, he took his passport, went down to the airline to get on the plane to go to Bangkok, but he was prevented from doing so. They confiscated his passport, they arrested him, put him in jail. He did everything he could to get out, to be reunited with his family. Over the next 5 years, he kept trying to escape, not once, not twice, not three times, but five times he tried and failed. Always rearrested. The abuse, the deprivation, always cranked up until he tried again. The sixth time it worked. The sixth time he got out, he got into Cambodia, but unfortunately he was captured there by the Khmer Rouge, perhaps one of the world's nastiest terrorist organizations in the last century. And the Khmer Rouge deprived him. The Khmer Rouge abused him. But he escaped from there with 30 other people. They escaped from the prison camp. They found a boat, and they rowed all the way to Thailand, where they were put into a refugee camp. Meanwhile, during all these years, while all this is happening, his wife gives birth to a little girl. And she wants her little girl and her little boy to know their dad. So they have a picture, and they look at it every day, and they talk about him, and they pray for him every day. And I know this sounds weird, but true story, this little girl, she never spoke. She seemed like fully with it, fully intelligent, fine, but she never spoke. Maybe because of the sadness of talking about a dad that she did not know and had never seen and been with. Nobody knows, but for whatever reason, she was unwilling and unable to speak. But then they got word. They got word that dad was in this refugee camp in Thailand. And so they took off for him. And when that little girl saw her dad, she knew immediately it was him. And she ran into his arms and jumped into his arms and talked and talked and talked. They said she never shut up. One day we're going to see Jesus for the first time. And we're going to know it's him. We're going to know it's him because we've been walking with him here. We've been talking with him here. We're going to know it's him because we've seen him in his word. We've seen him in the gospel. And we're going to run to him because though we have not seen him, we love him. And we're going to say to him, I love you, Jesus. And we're never going to stop declaring his praises. Amen.